ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
In the course of my travels, I've been recording nature soundscapes with the aim of helping you, Australia, to relax. And in this particular overnight recording, there was this one duck that just kept screaming its guts out. Anyway, don't worry, I've selected only the best, most relaxing soundscapes that absolutely do not feature this duck. Find Nature Sounds by Anne Jones wherever you get your podcasts and on the ABC Listen app.
Belle, my first annoying question to you and to our listener, who said, "I don't know if there's a God, but if there is, she or he has an inordinate fondness of Beatles"?
Good question. I imagine it's someone like Paul McCartney or maybe Ringo.
Well be right. They love... Well, I know McCartney loves science.
They've done well for themselves, yeah. Let's be honest here. No, it was JBS Haldane, of course.
The reason I ask is that the journal Nature this week has a paper saying a tiny patch of the Amazon probably holds 40,000 species, many of them new to science. Just imagine what other species such as nematodes amount to.
What's all this chat about nematodes, Robin? Where are you going with this?
My point is that there's so much out there to study, for young people, for all of us there to enjoy. Flowers and creatures, and it's all in The Science Show here on ABC Radio National.
I'm Belinda Smith.
And I'm still Robin Williams. But another connected theme, one we've highlighted in The Science Show for this year, is our need for more young scientists, plus the courses for them to do at our local universities. We need botanists, geologists, and those who love worms, nematodes included. Meet Elissa Hallam, Professor of Microbiology at UCLA. Now, there was a British scientist, slightly eccentric, who once said, "I don't know whether there is a God, but if there is, she or he is extraordinarily fond of beetles." But I think you could say so even more as fond of nematodes. Would you agree?
There certainly are a lot of nematodes, yeah, both free-living and parasitic. So, yeah, they're found everywhere. They're found in really crazy environments. They're very widespread.
Tiny creatures, and they're worm-like. What are they like in terms of the complexity of their bodies? Do they have organs and so on?
Yeah, they do. I mean, the interesting thing about nematodes is that their body plans are relatively similar in different species, even if they're a human parasite versus a free-living worm. But yeah, they have the pharynx that they use for eating, and then they have the nerve ring, which is kind of like the worm brain, and they have, you know, muscle.
A brain? They've got a brain?
Yeah, they have a big collection of neurons that people think of as the brain of the worm.
And which ones do you study?
We study primarily a worm called Strongyloides stercoralis, which is a human parasite, and it's also known as the thread worm. So it's a skin-penetrating worm.
That worries me. Is that a problem? Where does it go when it's penetrated?
So it penetrates through the skin. Any exposed skin that it encounters, again, they go to the bloodstream and then get carried through the bloodstream to the lungs. And then one of the symptoms of being infected is you get a dry cough, you get irritation in your lungs, and when you cough, you end up coughing the worms and swallowing them, and then they travel. When you swallow them, that's how they get to your small intestine. And then in the small intestine, they kind of nestle in the intestinal mucosa and develop there.
And they're unaffected by acid?
Well, they can survive, can pass through the stomach, and yeah, they're pretty resistant to acidic environments.
Do they cause an illness that's a worry?
They do cause an illness. So there are people who are infected and are asymptomatic, but they can also make you quite sick. They can cause, you know, gastrointestinal distress, a lot of gastrointestinal pain, malnourishment. If children are infected, it can cause cognitive impairment and delayed growth in children. And then the real danger for Strongyloides is that they can be fatal if you're immunosuppressed. So in people who are immunosuppressed, the worms can travel throughout your entire body, and they just replicate in large numbers, so you get worms everywhere, and they travel all over the place, and then that's often fatal.
How do they gain the entry? Are they in food you eat or what?
Some worms are, but these skin-penetrating worms are generally in contaminated soil. And so a lot of times it's soil contaminated with feces, so they pass out of the body feces, and then if you're near an outhouse or something like that, and so if people are walking barefoot through soil, that's typically how they would get infected.
Oh! So they can actually get through the hardened skin of your foot.
Yes, they can penetrate through the skin. So one of the things we've been doing recently is studying skin penetration. And the reason is because nothing was known about this, right? These are skin penetrating worms, but almost nothing was really known about the behaviors. So this is something we've been looking at. And if it's intact, like bottom of the foot skin, it's actually pretty hard for them to get in. But when people are walking barefoot through soil, if you walk barefoot, you're going to have all sorts of little microabrasions on your feet. And if there's any kind of little cut like that, they just dive right in. And they can also get in the top of the skin. So typically people are thought to be infected in the skin between their toes where it's softer, or the top of the foot. And we found the worms can easily get in that skin.
I go running barefoot every day.
I don't do that. Yeah, I tend to wear shoes. But you know, it really depends on where you're running, I guess. I mean, there are a lot of Strongyloides infections in Australia.
Are there? Okay. And what is your particular line to resist this infection?
I mean, one of the things that we're interested in research-wise is trying to figure out, like, what drives them toward a human host and then what drives them into the skin and see if we can develop ways to block that. So, for example, like, if we could develop a trap or repellent on your feet and now they're no longer attracted to you and they don't go toward you, then that would be one way to prevent infections. And if we can figure out like what odors, that's one thing we look at, like what body odors are they attracted to that drive them toward a human? And if so, perhaps we can use that in a trap. Mm-hmm. And also for skin penetration, like what are the mechanisms, what molecular pathways do they need to get inside a human foot? And then if figure that out, we can block those pathways to try to prevent infections.
And is there a drive, you know, people concerned about your research out in the public, in medical outfits and so on, asking you to do this because there's a problem in certain places where people need to have that kind of medical backup?
I just think it's a huge understudied health problem. I mean, the reason there isn't really anyone asking us, I think, is because these worms are neglected. I mean, Strongyloidiasis is classified as a neglected tropical disease. And even though it's a very prevalent disease, it's estimated that over 600 million people are infected worldwide, but it's mostly in low resource settings. And so that's why in many ways they're sort of ignored, I think.
Poorer nations, in other words. 600 million people.
Yeah, like less wealthy nations or less wealthy parts of existing nations. So, I mean, there are parts of the United States where there have been Strongyloides outbreaks and think it's just, it's not going to be in a big city, but in lower resource, more rural settings, it's a huge problem.
Any clues so far? What puts them off?
Well, we've been looking at dopamine signaling is important for their drive to penetrate skin. So if you disrupt dopamine signaling, for example, then they tend to crawl around on the skin, but they don't really penetrate much. And so that's an example where a topical compound that you put on your skin that could block the nematode dopamine signaling pathway could potentially prevent them from wanting to get inside the skin. So when we block their dopamine signaling, they still crawl around. They just seem not very motivated to actually penetrate into the skin.
Yeah, dopamine is such a fundamental ingredient for human beings. I'd imagine there would be some exuding.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that's interesting is there are nematode-specific components of the dopamine pathway. So one of the components that we looked at was this mechanoreceptor that's involved in dopamine signaling that's specific to worms. It's a TRP channel. And so that, for example, is a compound that might be of interest because if you could block that nematode-specific component of the dopamine pathway, it would presumably not have an effect on humans, but could prevent the worms from going in the skin.
Dopamine is one of the things where if I'm turning on a telly and there's something I really like, doing, you get a dopamine buzz. So it's so common that one wonders what particular association would put them off. But are you working with drug companies at all in that regard?
No, we're not doing any work now with drug companies, but that's sort of a long-term interest in the future, right? I mean, if we could get to the point of developing potential compounds that could be drug targets, that would be of interest. But we're still in the early stages of like basic research. There's just really so little known about their behavior. And I mean, there really are not a lot of anti-worm drugs that are currently used. I mean, that's the big problem right now. So if you get infected with Strongyloides, you can take ivermectin, which is the drug that's generally used to treat infections, and that's effective. But the issues are that it doesn't prevent reinfection. You know, there's no vaccine right now that's used against these worms. And so if you live in an endemic area where the worms are present, you can take ivermectin, but 6 months or a year later, you're going to get reinfected, right? So it's a constant problem. And also because of frequent administration of drugs, drug resistance is a growing concern. And so for strongylated species that infect non-human animals, drug resistance has already been documented. And so it's expected that in the future, in the near future, they'll probably be resistant to the available drugs. But there just really aren't that many drugs. And so we really need new drugs now before drug resistance develops.
So there you have it, 600 million humans infected and creatures so small we may not notice. But one piece of advice, don't be like me and allow your socks to get smelly. Finally, you talk about the behaviour of these tiny creatures. They're so small, they're microscopic, as you said. Have they shown any sign of learning things when you see them down the microscope? Do they do things you can predict? Are they interesting?
They're really interesting. I mean, they have really amazing behaviours, and that's one of the reasons we study them too. I think it's a really good example of parasitic behaviors, and they have all these behaviors, and you know why they're doing that behavior. I think that's the thing that I find most exciting. We know that what this worm needs when it's in the infective stage is it needs to find a human, and it needs to find a human and it needs to get inside that human. And so the behaviors of the infective larvae are just geared toward how can I find a human and then how can I infect? So they show a ton of interesting behaviors. I mean, they're very sensitive to body heat. If you turn on a heat source, whatever, they go nuts. They stand up on their tail and wave their head around. And so they're very active. Just with a tiny bit of heat, they get very, very active. And they migrate toward a heat source. If you put them in a gradient that goes from, you know, room temperature to body temperature, then they just all go up almost directly up the gradient to body temperature and just hang out there. They also respond to human odors, and the worms are really attracted to sweaty foot odor. Yeah, we've collected air from worn socks. So we have people wear socks, and then we take the stinky sock and we collect it on the piece of foam, and then we can deliver a little puff of that to the worm, and they really like the foot odor, and the presence of foot odor causes them to go in even faster to the skin. So that's a preliminary result that we're looking at. So yeah, it's really cool. I mean, they respond to like vibration, right? So when a human is walking by, they're going to give off a ton of sensory cues. They're going to cause vibrations in the soil. They're going to have body heat. They're going to have, you know, body odor, and the worms will respond to all of these cues.
So folks, change your socks, wash your feet. Thank you.
Thanks. Good talking to you.
Elissa Hallam is Professor of Microbiology at UCLA, and this is The Science Show, where the answer to my question about God and beetles was posed by one of the greatest and most eccentric scientists, J.B.S. Haldane. He studied maths and classics and revolutionized evolutionary ideas. Belle, away with smelly socks. Give us more flowers.
Yes, something a little less stinky. It is National Science Week, and this year, ABC Science is running a poll to find Australia's most amazing wildflower. You can check out the contenders right now, Robin, and cast your vote at abc.net.au/wildflowers.
And what makes a flower a wildflower?
A wildflower is not a botanical term. You know, we generally think of wildflowers as these things that pop up every year, they bloom for a short period, and then they disappear. But really, a wildflower is any flower that just blooms in the wild. And we have around 20,000 flowering plants in Australia, and some of them are pretty wacky. They really put the wild in wildflower. Some of them are incredibly proficient hunters as well. So to learn about some of these particular specimens, I went to the herbarium at the University of Melbourne to chat to curator Dr. Joe Birch.
I'll start by acknowledging that we're on the Parkville campus on the Wurundjeri lands of the Kulin Nation.
What are some of the more unusual wildflowers you have here in the herbarium collection?
Yes. So I think I've picked several species with structures that move, which I think is really interesting actually, isn't it? Because we don't think of plants moving very much.
There's a big wooden table in the middle of the room. All right, let's walk around the table.
So
ooh, more specimens. And Joe has placed what look like large manila folders on top of it. Each folder's open, showing different dried botanical specimens stuck to big sheets of white cardboard. Okay, so what have we got here?
So I've pulled out some specimens of Drosera, which is a wildflower with the common name sundew. And for those that get out walking in trails in the national park, they're conspicuous despite the fact that they can be very tiny. there's about 260 species worldwide, and Australia is the centre of diversity of that species diversity. So we have about 160 species here in Australia. It's thought that in Australia they're very prolific because they're carnivorous, and so they use and are able to extract nutrients from insects. And we, of course, here in Australia have lots of soils that are nutrient poor, particularly poor in nitrogen and phosphorus. And the plant has adapted to those conditions by eating insects, if you like. So a couple of the specimens, one that I thought was really nice, this one is Drosera glandulifera, and it's quite a small plant. The leaves are those structures at the bottom.
You can see the little hairs poking out of the dried specimens. They're very delicate and very short, but I imagine they're quite sticky.
Quite sticky, that's right. So this entire plant is, 9 centimetres tall? And with many Drosera, when they're not flowering, all you see is this basal rosette of leaves with these glandular hairs that cover the surface, and they secrete mucilage. So when the insects crawl over the leaves or alight onto the leaf, they'll get caught in that mucilage. Then, of course, they struggle. And Drosera are interesting because this particular species has two kinds of glands or hairs on the leaves. One on the outside are a little bit smaller, but they have a trip mechanism. So when they sense an insect on them, they release and push the insect into the centre of the leaf, which is where the glandular hairs are that secrete the mucilage. So quite surprisingly, the insect gets trapped, and then some of those other mucilaginous sort of hairs are able to move towards the insect, and it really gets held fast. So it's a gory death for the insect. It will either struggle so much that it wears itself out, or it suffocates from the mucilage and is not able to get the oxygen that it needs. And interestingly also, the leaf glands then secrete an enzyme that break down the insect, the chitin and the innards of the insect, and then are able to extract out the nitrogen to build more proteins. So a really interesting plant.
So interesting. And so the enzymes break down the insect to see the bits of the insect ooze into the soil, and that's uptaken by the roots, or is it through the leaves?
Normally plants uptake nutrients from their roots. In this case, I understand that the nutrients are absorbed through glands on the leaves, because that's where they are, that's where the insects are. And I thought the ultimate irony, actually, is that plants require insects typically for pollination. Drosera not only uses the insects for nutrients, but it also uses the insects as pollinators. So often what you see when you see this growing is these very large clusters of flowers, the inflorescences that have beautiful white, or in this case, orange flowers. They're often on long stalks, and they attract the insects again, but this time to the flower, not to extract nutrients, but this time for something else. So there's these amazing interactions for Drosera with different insect species. If you were an insect, you might prefer to be the pollinator rather than food.
So I assume that the flowers are kind of up on these stalks, even though the stalks aren't terribly tall, just so that the pollinating insects aren't accidentally then consumed by the plant itself.
That's right. So this species is very small, but not all of Drosera species are. So there's a species in Western Australia, Drosera gigantea, that grows to a metre tall. So this flowering stalk covered in flowers is really quite a long way from the leaves in that case.
The next specimens we look at are wispy, fragile-looking plants covered in what look like tiny little berries. But these are not berries. Okay, so what have we got here now?
I pulled out a couple of specimens of Utricularia. The common name of this one is bladderwort, This one that we can talk about first, Utricularia dichotoma, has a common name, fairy's apron. So you get these common names are actually very descriptive, yeah. aren't they? And I think in this case, they're describing the shape of the flower. So the flowers in this species are purple. They're white or a pale sort of pinky purple, and they have the lower part is a very large, wide sort of apron shape. Mm-hmm. That's the fairy's apron. The really interesting thing about this genus and species, though, is not the flowers, as pretty as they are, it's the roots. This is, once again, a carnivorous plant, but they're carnivorous in a slightly different way. So this plant grows in swampy and aquatic environments and produces these underground stems. The botanical term is a stolon. They scramble along underneath the surface, and they have these little bladders that grow on the stolon. The bladder has a really interesting mechanism for sucking in nematodes and underwater larvae into that bladder. The bladder excretes salts from that little bladder. As a result, the water moves out of the bladder also, and that sets up a pressure system, a low pressure system. There's tiny hairs on the apex of the bladder, and when nematodes or anything else, little larvae, brush against those hairs, the bladder opens and the pressure sucks the aquatic organism into this bladder, and the bladder closes and once again secretes digestive enzymes to metabolize the nutrients in this aquatic environment. And aquatic environments are often nutrient poor. The metabolism of nutrients is difficult in you know, watery environments. So here Utricularia gets a little shot of nitrogen for its subsequent growth. So really interesting, completely different to the Drosera, which has the leaves that are producing the carnivorous component.
So a little worm or something will be, you know, crawling around, and then all of a sudden it's sucked in, and then it just gets digested by the plant.
That's right. And it happens very quickly, in a matter of milliseconds. So this is a very quick response.
The specimens on our final stop of our spring-loaded plant tour are possibly the best known of the bunch.
These are trigger plants. Trigger plants have the Latin binomial Stylidium, and they have their vegetative structures at the base and then this really tall cluster of flowers on a stalk. The standard, what you think of as a classic wildflower form. These two species are actually interesting. The flowers on both of these species are bright pink, and once again, they have a mechanism which allows a really interesting interaction with pollinators. What we have, and you can see in these flowers, is that the corolla, the petals, are in four parts, which provide a really nice shot of colour which entices pollinators to visit. The male and female structures on the plant are fused into what's called a column, and that column is cocked. So it's held back or to the side in such a way that when the pollinator lands on the flower, it releases the trigger and the column moves and touches the pollinator. So that's the trigger plants.
So there might be a fly which lands on a trigger plant flower, just wanting something to eat, and then bam, it gets smacked in the back with the flower's sex organs. And then it goes to another flower and the same thing happens again, but that's the way the pollen spread.
And actually, they reset. If the plant is not pollinated, the trigger resets. I mean, it's so novel, isn't it? And, you know, this is why we see the diversity of flowers, the diversity of colours, the diversity of structures, is that we're selecting for naturally effective ways of being competitive. And, yeah, plants find every possible way to either get the nutrients that they need or find ways to reproduce and produce in the next generation.
Jo Birch, senior lecturer and herbarium curator at the University of Melbourne. And Birch, there's a bit of nominative determinism there. Now, Australia might have thousands of flowering plants today, but what did our first flower look like and when did it bloom? Vera Corosides at the University of Melbourne is a paleontologist who specialises in pollen and spores. And she's analysed ancient pollen to discover just when Australia's oldest known flowering plants lived.
The evidence we have for Australia's oldest flowering plants come from some very special rocks in Victoria, and they're around 125 million years old.
So we're talking dino plants.
100% plants during the time of the dinosaurs.
And what did Australia's oldest flowers look like?
Australia's oldest flowers probably looked a little like modern magnolias, and another option would be some modern buttercups.
What fossil evidence is there for these flowers?
The evidence we have for the very oldest flowers isn't the flowers themselves. They do appear, but a bit later on. We actually find their reproductive units, which is the fossilised pollen, and that's exactly what we've used to determine when they first appear in the rock record. There are a few different methods we use to determine how old the rocks are. One of them is using the fossils themselves. So fossils appear and disappear on Earth in a very specific order, and that's something paleontologists have documented through time. So effectively, we can use the first appearance of key fossils to help us determine where we are in a relative sense. We can also use a technique known as absolute dating, where we can look at particular elements in the rocks and they can give us an age in millions of years. And we've done both to determine when the flowering plant first evolved and appeared here in Australia.
So the first flowering plants in Australia, did they migrate from elsewhere or did they just evolve here themselves?
The first flowering plants actually spread into Australia. They first evolved in the equator where it was very warm, and within 10 million years of first appearing on the planet, they'd actually spread to all seven continents. If we were to go for a walk in a Mesozoic forest when the dinosaurs had first evolved, there would be no flowering plants in the landscape. However, now they're over 80, 90% of what you see are flowering plants today. So they've become very successful very quick.
How does ancient pollen fossilise?
Because reproduction is so important to the future of plants, they protect their reproductive components. And so pollen is made out of this phenomenal compound known as sporopollenin, and it's one of the most naturally resistant occurring substances. So actually, pollen can preserve in rock for hundreds of millions of years. The oldest known pollen is around 380 million years old and comes from cone-producing plants.
Conifers?
Spot on.
Are we able to look at some of this ancient pollen?
Got my microscope ready to show you what they look like. Under the microscope here in the center is an example of one of the first flowering plants that we have, and it's a tiny little pollen grain, thinner than the width of one human hair, and you'll see it right in the center there.
I'm leaning down to the microscope. Oh, wow. So how old is this piece of pollen?
This piece of pollen here is around 105 million years old.
Whoa! Am I seeing three lobes on it?
That's correct. Yep, that's very characteristic of flowering plants, and that's exactly how we know it was produced from a flowering plant.
Do we know what the flower would have looked like?
Not at this stage. It's up for speculation. So what we really hope to do is complete some more field work. Hopefully we'll find an actual physical flower with the anthers which contain the pollen attached, and then we can make the link between the flower and the pollen.
What's all this other stuff around it?
So some of the other things around it are other types of fossil pollen and spores. So in the same slide, we've got some evidence of tree ferns and some beautiful conifers and some other bits of plant remains that are also really resilient and resistant.
So we can tell a little bit about what the environment was at this time. If we were to walk through it, what would we see?
There'd be huge braided rivers, there'd be conifers all around us, it'd be very lush, there'd be tree ferns and ferns lining the river, and if we're very lucky, we might see some very small little flowering plants growing in the understory.
Do we know how these old flowering plants were pollinated?
We have some theories, and the leading theory at the moment is that beetles acted as really important pollinators for the first flowering plants.
Why beetles are not like, I don't know, flies or wasps?
We think beetles, for whatever reason, had a wonderful affiliation with the first flowers, and then eventually there were certainly flies involved and eventually bees as well, but The current evidence suggests beetles were the first to adapt and make the most of the new source of food, which was the pollen.
Flowering plants that are present today, would they be descended from these ancient species?
Yeah, we definitely find evidence in the fossil record that the modern day flowers did evolve from these original flowering plants, some of them at least.
Does this work change the way you look at flowers?
Most definitely. I think it's just so fascinating to think about how quickly they diversified. You know, the evolution of plants in general forever changed our planet, but you'd argue that the evolution of flowering plants in particular and their ability to grow really, really fast and cope with changing amounts of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has been instrumental in shaping our planet today.
Dr. Vera Corosides, who studies ancient pollen at the University of Melbourne. She's recently started hunting for fossilised pollen from Antarctic rocks, if you can believe it, to piece together the movement of flowering plants all those years ago. And if you want more on the first flowers, I highly recommend checking out What the Duck. They've done an amazing episode about it. Check it out on ABC Listen.
This is The Science Show on ABC Radio National. And yes, in National Science Week, we're featuring flowers, but also in the face of sliding standards of school and limited support for universities, a call for the next generation of scientists to take over the challenge.
You hinted that the next 40 years are going to be very rough. What did you mean by that?
Over the next 40 years, even though population growth is projected to slow down, over the next 30 to 40 years, we'll still be adding another couple of billion people, and we can't feed the population that we have now. We're doing irreversible damage to many of the productive systems in the world, to soils, to agricultural lands, to forests, to biodiversity, to the atmosphere. Right now, can't feed people. A quarter of the people in the world are basically living in absolute poverty, little scientific literacy around the world, little ability to reverse it. And if you put all that together and then you throw in another couple of billion people, which is what we're doing, I see it as if we're passing through the rapids and we have to come out the other side in some kind of ordered way. It's up to us how well we do that or how badly.
Peter Raven, the botanist, he died in April. Raven was a superstar. And though gifted, is a splendid example for young people of how someone with determination and vision, and I'm reminded of our own Bridget Ogilvie, can do work that really does make the world a better place. Raven once ran the Missouri Botanic Garden, and here is our very own Peter Bernhardt, who also hails from that place.
We lost botanist, author, conservationist, administrator, planner, and advisor Dr. Peter Raven on the 25th of April, 2026. He made such an impact on the lives of so many people, the Missouri Botanical Garden had to schedule two tributes in June. His widow, Pat, and the garden administrators decided it would be best to hold events in June, as the 13th was his birthday. He would have been 90. The first service on Saturday was held to honor what you would call the public Peter Raven. When you signed the guest book, you were offered a cough lolly and a packet of wildflower seed. Then you walked down a corridor to find a cluster of exhibition cabinets. One contained 51 medals, honorary keys, and plaques, including a complicated net of silver chains and medallions from the Vatican. Dr. Raven had been an environmental advisor to at least two popes, the current Dalai Lama, and several American presidents. Peter Raven spent a lot of time in Washington, D.C., enduring committee work. At the end of these meetings, he would announce, "It's been absolutely lovely, but I have to scream now." Additional cabinets testified to the thoroughness of the staff of the garden's museums, archives, and library. Here was the original cover of Time magazine from the 26th of April, 1999, naming him Hero of the Planet, while caricaturing him in a Superman cape. There was a copy of his co-authored university textbook, Biology of Plants. I taught from that book for over 30 years through six of its eight editions. Here was a pressed specimen of the first plant species Raven described as a lad of 17 with botanist D.H. Lewis. it was Clarkia franciscana, a Californian wildflower. Peter Raven later became a specialist on Clarkias and their relatives, the fuchsias, sundrops, evening primroses, and fireweeds, all placed in the family Onagraceae. The auditorium was tastefully decorated with fresh arrangements of white or pastel-colored roses, Canterbury bells, carnations, and some hybrids of Australian rock orchids. A violinist and cellist played classical duets as we watched a revolving slideshow of Raven's life, including a photo of the young, still-bearded botanist holding a baby wombat in front of a background that looked like the Australian Alps or Tasmanian Highlands. He came to Australia and New Zealand in the 1960s to collect native fireweeds to revise the genus Epilobium. During the service, I felt that Raven's zeal and contributions as a scientist took a back seat to the praise he received from the good and the great, including former trustees of the garden, the current mayor of St. Louis, representatives from the National Academy of Science, the Bezos Earth Fund, three American universities, and others, but some things can't be suppressed. Most of the audience knew Peter Raven was born in Shanghai, China, to missionary parents, but how many learned that day he spent over 20 years co-editing the flora of China? His Chinese colleagues thanked him repeatedly for integrating Chinese botany into the rest of the scientific world. No wonder his ashes are now in an antique Chinese urn. Kate Raven, one of his three daughters, summed it up for me when she spoke of a trip she and her father had taken in Tibet when he was 75. She described how he had her pull the vehicle over to the side so he could get down and collect fireweeds in a field. In fact, the Monday tribute to Peter Raven filled a science gap. The most effective speakers were former and current curators. They spoke of a man who rebuilt the reputation of a botanic garden, a boss who was at work by 5 or 5:30 a.m., and who found time to mentor dozens of graduate students. Clearly, he was such an advocate for his discipline, he could find millions of dollars every few years to fund various projects, including those 49 volumes of Flora of China published over 40 years. Perhaps the strongest voice for Raven that day was curator Tom Crowett. Incredibly, Tom has been with the garden 58 years and is among the few employees left who remembers before Raven took charge in 71. Tom remembered a time in which there were only 4 people running the herbarium before Raven hired 35 more and sent them to collect all over the world. Tom shared his memories of pre-Raven days when most professional botanists flew over Missouri because it was accepted that St. Louis lacked a significant collection. At last count, we passed 7 million specimens because one man understood how to bring out the best in his peers. I think 2 tributes offered a pretty fair synopsis of the value of Peter Raven to all willing to work with him. I say this is someone who benefited from his friendship and mentorship for 50 years. I started corresponding with him while a Peace Corps volunteer in El Salvador back in the mid-70s, but we didn't meet until the International Botanical Congress in Sydney in 81. What do I miss about him? His daughter Kate said it best. I miss the way he liked people.
Peter Bernhardt. So there we are, another example of how an unlikely person, a mere botanist, can change the world. Other examples and heroes of mine, Beatrix Potter, a writer, superb illustrator of botanical specimens, including flowers. She made millions from her books and used the money to buy stretches of the Lake District in England and save it for the nation and for the rest of the world. And Vicky Laurie in Perth, who's writing on our botanical hotspots, such as in the southwest of Western Australia, alerted the world to our treasures, flowers and worms. Science can lead anywhere. Take CERN in Switzerland. They have a mouse cage there in that Centre for Nuclear Research. But the mice are actually the controls from computers. Old mice are collected there. Yes, it's a nerdy joke. But as for the work now at CERN, our own Shelby Trainer investigates.
Start power group 43,479.
This is where we could uncover the secrets of the universe.
Start power group 43,480.
I'm in the control room of the Atlas experiment at CERN, though I'm not looking at the experiment itself. That's 100 metres under my feet. This is more like Atlas Command Center. Lots of chairs and lots of screens.
The one in the center, so usually that is my role, that's the shift leader, in charge for the operation of Atlas here.
Joni Pham is a PhD student from the University of Melbourne, currently based at CERN in Geneva. Atlas is part of the Large Hadron Collider, a massive particle accelerator that loops beneath Switzerland and France. It detects collisions of fast-moving particles.
We are not the type of scientist that is standing next to the experiment, like people would imagine. The experiment itself is actually 100 meters underground, because when the experiment is running, we have very high level of radiation, very strong magnetic field.
Occupational health and safety aside, Joni says there wouldn't be much to see anyway.
We don't really see the particles. We don't see the process. All we see would be the traces that they leave behind. Because first of all, the particles are very, very tiny. And secondly, we have 40 million collisions per second.
So what is the point of smashing particles together at almost the speed of light? Well, it's to recreate the conditions of the early universe, starting with the few millionths of a second after the Big Bang.
This is the moment that there was no star, no galaxy, no planet, and not even like atoms and molecules, just fundamental particles with very strong interaction. And this we call quark-gluon plasma.
This quark-gluon plasma is a hot, dense soup of particles.
And a lot of very strong interaction.
This is what Atlas is trying to recreate, and what Joni is working on at CERN, smashing together heavy, charged particles that, because of their heaviness, crash together at high enough energies to momentarily melt into a quark-gluon plasma.
So this is very similar to the condition of the universe just after the Big Bang.
Detectors surround the point of collision, recording the trajectory, momentum, and energy of particles. Computer algorithms help the scientists understand what they're seeing. The debris from these collisions is also important. It can contain elusive particles like the Higgs boson that blinks in and out of existence in a fraction of a second.
This may sound, you know, boring, just precise measurement. But precise measurements are very important because any deviation from previous studies may give us a hint to new physics.
Currently, our best understanding of the basic building blocks of matter and how they interact is called the Standard Model of Particle Physics.
This is the best tested theory so far. But unfortunately, this is only accounted for 5% of the universe.
There's more to the universe than the matter we see with our eyes. 95% of it is something else entirely.
So there's dark matter, dark energy. And also there are so many mysteries. For example, antimatter.
All of these phenomena hint at a physics beyond the Standard Model. To learn more about them, we leave the Atlas control room and head towards CERN's very own antimatter factory. And you get to meet another Australian.
Dr. Riley Henderson, I'm a research fellow at Monash University in Victoria. So we are all quite well familiar with what ordinary matter is. So these are the protons and neutrons and electrons that make up atoms, which are what makes up the entire world around us, including you and me. But nature decided to do something a little bit funny and make a perfect copy of all of the matter particles that exist, but with the opposite electric charge.
This is antimatter.
And so we have these weird mirror universes almost, where one is made of our ordinary matter and then we have antimatter. And there's an interesting conundrum that comes out of this.
The standard model predicts that ordinary matter and antimatter are always produced in equal amounts. However, when we look around, there's way more matter than antimatter. That's perplexing, but lucky, because otherwise we wouldn't be here.
And there's also this interesting idea that when you put matter and the corresponding antimatter particle together, they will actually annihilate into pure energy and there'll be no more matter left. And so if you trace that idea back to the beginning of the universe, all the matter and antimatter should have been produced in equal amounts and then subsequently annihilated with each other and there would be no universe left. So really this is trying to address the most fundamental question you could ask, I suppose, is why do we have a universe at all? And there's several ways that we are studying that here at CERN.
We've crossed the border from Switzerland into France to visit the only place in the world dedicated to making antimatter. Trapping antimatter can be tricky. After all, if it comes into contact with ordinary matter, it goes poof. So the antimatter has to be held in place by electromagnetic traps. And to trap the antimatter, the particles need to be slowed down, which is what you're hearing right now. The antiproton decelerator.
We are standing on top of the antiproton decelerator. It is not 100 meters underground like the Large Hadron Collider. It's just like a few meters below our feet here.
Joni says they use the laws of thermodynamics to slow down the speedy antiprotons.
So imagine that you have two glasses of water. One is hot, one is cold, and you place them in contact with each other. After some point, the temperature of the two glasses of water would be the same. Mm-hmm. And here, we use similar concept. We have the antiprotons that are very energetic. Then one of the towers here shoots electrons with much lower energy. Basically, there will be an energy transfer from high energy antiprotons to low energy electrons.
Yep, CERN is shooting electrons at antiprotons to slow them down. But not all experiments take this approach. Some go full steam ahead.
For example, using the Large Hadron Collider itself, where we can produce not just antiprotons, but also antiparticles of all these other heavier and more exotic particles that are contained in the standard model, like the Beauty Quark.
Riley is currently working on the Large Hadron Collider Beauty Experiment, or LHCB, which uses sub-detectors to measure particles thrown forwards after a collision.
So in our standard model of particle physics, we consider the world around us to be made up of particles that are called quarks. So there are six different types of quarks. There's the up, down, strange, charm, top and bottom, or also known as beauty quark. And our LHCB experiment is specifically interested in studying this beauty quark as precisely as possible.
And yes, all of these quarks have anti-quarks.
So that's what we do at LHCB. We produce beauty quarks and anti-beauty quarks, measure each one extremely precisely and try to look for any asymmetries, any differences in the production and the way that these particles subsequently decay into other particles.
Are there measurable differences between them that could explain where all the antimatter has gone and why it hasn't annihilated all the matter in existence?
It's really trying to understand this problem, what we call matter-antimatter asymmetry.
Essentially, Riley is studying beauty quarks and anti-beauty quarks to try and understand why the universe exists.
To expand our understanding of the fundamental laws of nature.
Another mystery of the early universe is dark matter. But we start to see its effect a little further along in the timeline, a few tens of millions of years after the Big Bang. It's theorized that dark matter gave the universe its structure, creating wells of gravity that enabled galaxies to form and continues to hold our galaxies together. But I say theorized because we've never actually observed it directly. That's what our final Aussie scientist is hoping to do.
Cale Kemp, physics PhD student from Adelaide University.
Cale will be putting in some shifts back at the Atlas control room, looking for anything out of the ordinary.
Usually what we'll do is we'll look for bumps in the distributions of variables. So we'll look at the energy of the objects or particles we see in the detector and we'll look for some sort of difference from the standard model. So by the end of the PhD, either I'd find dark matter, which would be a career highlight, that would be great, or we'll be able to set stricter bounds on where we might be able to find dark matter. So we might be able to rule out a certain mass range for where these particles might be. But either way, a lot of analyses are just about trying to find where particles aren't, you know, where dark matter isn't.
That's the big problem with dark matter. The parameters aren't well defined. We know it doesn't interact with light, but apart from that, we are literally and figuratively in the dark.
So I kind of describe it as you're looking for your keys in the morning, but you've never seen a key or a door. It's just a complete unknown, and you're just throwing spaghetti at a wall until you find something. And that's exactly what we're doing. We're throwing protons at each other until something interesting happens that we can't explain.
We finish off our tour at a warehouse where new magnets are being tested to supercharge these experiments here at CERN. At the time of this visit, the Large Hadron Collider was actually a few weeks away from shutting down. It will power back up in the mid-2030s as the upgraded high-luminosity Large Hadron Collider. In its new era, it's expected to smash more particles and uncover more about how the universe got its start.
Philosophically speaking, this is the type of question we have always been asking ourselves, right? For many, many generations, what are we made of? Where did we come from and where we are going to?
But Joni's takeaways from her time at CERN aren't all philosophical.
I have to say that since I came here, it's a life-changing moment because I could see a much bigger picture here. Before, I just focused on my analysis. But when I came here, I know that at CERN, there's not only the Large Hadron Collider. There are other experiments running in parallel with the Large Hadron Collider, like the antimatter factory. And there are also applied physics here that we use for medical study, for medical treatment. And at the same time, I've learned that here at CERN, not only they're doing fundamental research, but CERN has also contributed a lot to science communication and education to bring science to everyone. This is a very important thing, not only educating little kids, but also the parents.
Shelby Trainer at CERN in Switzerland, mixing with the muons. But after high tech and AI tech, lots of us, Belle, and I'll include you, certainly love to mix with wildflowers and the natural world. And last week, as we said vale to Bill Oddi of Goody's fame, I was reminded of what he said about those birds he loved and what they did for him.
Yes, what is it about watching birds? I mean, I get this lift somewhere in the countryside, as you describe, away from George Bush and Lagerlouts, and you see something. It doesn't have to be particularly rare. It gives you a tremendous lift, doesn't it?
It's very interesting you should put it that way, because I couldn't agree more. I mean, a lot of birders have this twitchy mentality, which is the chasing of rarities, and the rarity is really what excites them. But I couldn't agree with you more that there are moments, if I just look back over this past couple of weeks, on the visual moments that really excited me. They actually involve very common birds. One was at Werribee Sewage Farm, and it was a very calm afternoon, and there'd been a thunderstorm. The lake was absolutely calm, and there was a sky which was half black and half blue with this storm, and there was a rainbow straight through the sky, hit the lake, and then was reflected in it, so you got like a reflected rainbow. And at that moment, a single black swan just cruised very, very slowly right across this lake, like a mirror lake, and went straight through the rainbow. You know, you thought Steven Spielberg would have spent a month setting up that shot. You know, it was absolutely beautiful moment. Moments like that are terrific, yeah, involving common birds.
The late Bill Oddi. Birds, flowers. Like him, we all need a lift from the natural world.
Next week on The Science Show, birds and butterflies. And should we be rethinking the name of our ancient human ancestors? I'm Belinda Smith.
And I'm Robin Williams.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.